Hi guys, welcome to History and Game. Greetings, friends and well-wishers, and welcome to a very special episode of History and Game. So shower, shave, suit up, and let's shove off. Because in this episode, the one you're listening to right now, you will travel beyond the velvet rope, pull back the lace curtains, and see all the sordid and tawdry things you're not supposed to see within the podcast's metaphorical champagne room. Well, what do you expect? We can't keep the answer to life, the universe, and everything in a literal champagne room because A, we don't own a champagne room, and B, we could never afford a champagne room. Well, except a metaphorical one. We've got one of those. You may or may not have noticed that I end each and every episode with, "I hope I've given you something to think about." Okay, first I need to come clean. I didn't come up with the phrase. It comes from a woman named Candace Owens, who used to end her show, RIP, with the exact same phrase. In my defense, in case I need one, I'd bet dollars to donuts Candace spent 0.0 seconds writing her sign-off. So, if I'm stealing from anyone, it's from a minimum wage and overworked writer on a failed show that ran so short that pregnancies have lasted longer. Okay, second, and more importantly, History and Game doesn't just throw your high school history class and a Tom Vazel video into a blender and call it a day. Good heavens, no. This show provides something more. Ask the bigger questions, if you will. With the formulation of each and every episode, I keep my appropriated sign-off in mind in the attempt to give you something to think about. So, let's begin. France, 1793. France is in a period of radical political and societal change. The nation's spike in population, interest payments, and government debt send the country into a deep economic depression. Unemployment and high food prices spark unrest and ignite tempers as social and economic inequality deepen the stark polarization between the haves and the have-nots. The Queen of France is a bright-eyed beauty named Marie Antoinette. Antoinette loves exotic jewelry, fine shoes, and, most importantly, ostentatious dresses and gowns. While Antoinette spends the evening drinking and dancing in a lavish ballroom, a riot breaks out over the cost of bread. While Antoinette slips into a flowing dress, a weeping mother wanders the street carrying a lifeless child. Eventually, from coast to coast, every man, woman, and child despises Marie Antoinette. Without the use of social media and digital programming, Antoinette has become the Kim Kardashian of France. Wow, impressive. I mean, you've got to give it to her. In 1792, the National Convention Committee signs legislation establishing France as a new republic. The first order of the first day? A call for an immediate elimination of the monarchy. Problema numero uno. Antoinette's astounding inability to read the room. Listen, girlfriend, I'm not asking you to traipse around in a potato sack, girl, okay, but you've got to dial it back. Seriously, what's wrong with you? Problema numero dos. When the world robs you of your royal title, you don't get to just say nope and carry on, okay? Exploding kittens doesn't work in the real world. Instead, you collect yourself, fix your hair, and start browsing travel brochures. When your reputation indicates an extraordinary lack of success, it's time to get the HE double hockey sticks out of Dodge. Well, Antoinette disliked the idea. She wanted to stay a queen girl in her queen world. After a 2-month delay, Antoinette and her family make an unmotivated and half-assed attempt to flee the scene. They are fugitives on the lam for less than an episode of Inspector Gadget before being recognized and turned over to the authorities. Were disguises invented after the 1800s? Come on, man. You're the notorious former king and queen. Of course someone's gonna spot you. 2 years later, Antoinette stands trial, where she is found guilty of high treason and sentenced to death by guillotine. Time out. Hold up. High treason? Death by guillotine? I'll be right back. I have the definition of high treason in my hand, and it states, quote, high treason are crimes committed with the intent to put the nation or parts thereof under foreign rule or influence, unquote. Now, as I've already stated, Antoinette may have been about as sharp as a bag of wet dog hair, but high treason? Either the ump got the call wrong, or the country's vitriolic anger towards the former queen is so pervasive that death was the only option. At 12:15 p.m. on October 16, 1793, Marie Antoinette faced the guillotine. She was 37 years old. Rome, 46 BCE. Julius Caesar returns to Rome from his highly successful northern military campaign. The next day, he takes audience with the Senate, where he outlines his comprehensive plan that is 100% guaranteed to make Rome great again. The Republic grants Caesar with temporary administrative power. Not long after, Caesar declares himself dictator for life, disbands the Senate, and dissolves the Roman Republic. Caesar centralizes administrative tasks, bolsters military forces, and enacts three new policies of insular imperialism, aggressive expansion, and subjugation. A group of senators consider Caesar's blatant abuse of power insufferable. The group submit a formal request asking Caesar to abdicate his role as dictator, and he refuses. The group's second request begs Caesar to relinquish his position for the good of the Republic. And again, he refuses. Wow, what a Roman dirtbag. And to this day, we still use Caesar's calendar. Seriously, go look it up. On March 15th, eight senators armed with daggers ambush Caesar. Moving quickly, they surround the dictator. In a matter of moments, he is stabbed 23 times. A dying and bloody Caesar lays on the large front steps of the Theater of Pompeii. He makes a feeble attempt to pull his body up the steps, but bleeds out and dies. Contrary to popular belief, Julius Caesar's last words were not "A tu, Brute." In fact, his final words were "What's up?" Just playing. According to historians, they were something more along the lines of. England, 1192. Richard the Lionheart serves as a commander in the King's Crusade. He knows nothing but war and violence. With every charge into battle, it may be his last, but he pays such things no mind. He remains in the fray because he chooses to remain. He fights because he chooses to fight. 3 years prior, Richard is crowned King of England. However, Richard's heart is restless. His life's purpose is to fight for king and country, not to be a king idling away at a castle in the country. Longing for a life of his choosing, Richard abdicates, names his younger brother, John Lackland, to serve in his absence as the country's king regent, and rides off beyond the horizon. Meanwhile, the King Regent of England, King John, sits on his throne at Windsor Castle. After watching his older brother ride off, he calls for the immediate imprisonment of their mother. See, John believed that his mother did not love him the way she loves Richard. As the years passed, John's resentment towards his mother grew inside of him like a cancer, blackening his eyes with anger and twisting his soul with cruelty. But John Lackland was nobody, However, John Lackland, the King Regent of England, was somebody. Then King John immediately decides to abandon his wife, Isabella, the Countess of Gloucester, and remarry the Countess Isabella of Angoulême. On the day of her wedding to John, Isabella had just turned 12 years old. King John's power and authority allow him to indulge in his desires. During his reign, King John had 5 children with Isabella and 5 children with 3 of his mistresses and 2 noble women. Now, to be fair, it's commonplace for kings to engage in sexual relations with their mistresses. However, committing lust with a noble woman, now, that was an act of pure heresy. As the years passed, the country became dark and dismal. England's economy became weak. Trading became sparse, morale became meager, and food became non-existent. King John's abuse of power continues on and on with reckless abandon, and yet he is afraid. There is only one threat to his power, the return of the true King of England, his brother. The power of the crown provides the king feudal rights, bigger court fees, increased land taxes, and the widely unpopular garnishing of military wages. Typically, kings only subjected citizens to such draconic feudal rights to provide for emergency wartime provisions. Like when the enemy darkens the castle keep, ready to kill you, rape your wife, and steal your pig. Or steal your wife, rape you, and kill your pig. Or kill your wife, steal you, and rape your pig. You get the picture. Instead of putting the money back into the betterment of the country, King John hires a group of thugs to murder members of the royal administration. Royal administrators, appointed by King Richard before leaving to fight in the Crusades, with the sole duty and power to reallocate the throne back to Richard when, or if, he ever returns. With the royal administration bumped off, should Richard return, King John could imprison or kill his brother, and none would be the wiser. It's kind of like joining a top-secret agency, working undercover as a member of a deadly terrorist organization, only to find that everyone aware of the mission and your top-secret status as a spy are killed. Without a single person to vouch for you, well, now, in the eyes of the law, you're nothing more than a terrorist. Yeah, it's kind of like that. However, King John's assassination plot takes a turn for the worst when an unidentified outlaw archer and his merry men intercept the king's plans. In a blink of an eye, the thugs are left bound, tied, and unconscious. The events are told and retold and retold. Historians don't know when or how, but over the next century, the story is retold to the point where somewhere along the passing and retelling, the archer is given a name, Robin Hood. As fate would have it, another opportunity arises. The Third Crusade is an overwhelming success. Having survived the campaign, Richard the Lionheart departs from Jerusalem, beginning his voyage back to England. Back to his home. During his return, Richard is captured, handed over to the Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV, and imprisoned. Richard's release is set at £100,000 of silver. King John does the unimaginable. He offers Henry IV £80,000 of silver to not release his brother, ever. King John's cold-hearted request bothers the emperor, but, as the story goes, he accepts the 80,000, well, hell's bells, as it turns out Americans don't have a patent on being greedy. In fact, the concept has universal application. Color me enlightened. Richard remains imprisoned for a year, until one morning he is awoken by a prison guard. The guard looks down at Richard and says, "It is time for me to go home. It is time for you to go home, too." The guard bids him farewell and walks away, with Richard's cell door unlocked and wide open as he leaves. Richard the Lionheart returns to England, where, for the second time in his life, he is crowned the King of England. Now, I don't want to leave you with any misinformation. What historians know is that Richard's release came directly from Henry IV. It wasn't due to a disgruntled guard upset about the prison guard's union wages or anything like that. What historians don't know is exactly why Henry IV keeps Richard in prison for a year, only to let him go. Why the change of heart? Not only do we not know, but we never will know. That information is forever hidden beyond the velvet rope, behind the curtains, tucked away in the champagne room of history. Marie Antoinette, Julius Caesar, King John, power, control, authority. Humans crave power, whether in the form of wealth, respect, status, notoriety, privilege. You know what? To make my brain hurt just a little bit less, from here on, I'm just going to use power as a placeholder for all the things. Okay? Let's see. Where was I? Yes. The want of power is an intrinsic part of human behavior. It's in our DNA. To paraphrase Jacques Lacan, be careful what you wish for. Not because you'll get it. Oh, no, my little Riley cakes. Because once you get it, you're doomed to a life with it. Forever. The things you own, even the abstract, intangible ones, end up owning you. This is power. This is corruption. Sadly, our you-do-you society has increased how individuals pursue, achieve, and wield power. Greed, it's everywhere. The blatant misuse of power is toxic. Sacrificing mental health for wealth is not only commonplace, but expected. With movies like The Social Network, The Wolf of Wall Street, and The Dropout, we've developed a hedonic system of right over virtue, and that you can't achieve a single iota of power without being a complete douche nozzle. The want of power, in whatever form, has normalized behavior such as assessing friendships based on the value they bring to your table, degenerating your sense of altruism over narcissism, and pissing hundreds of people off, all in the name of achieving power. Seriously, our culture is full of it. You don't just see it until you look. You know what I mean, Vern? Before moving on, let's recap. We want power. We sacrifice our values in the name of achieving power. Then, once achieved, we are unable to relinquish our power. And finally, our power corrupts who we are forever and ever. Amen. So, what's the answer? Where do we go from here? How can society learn to subjugate our power before it destroys us, like a cancer, slowly, from the inside out? To not end on a deeply cynical note, I have the answer. Well, okay, it's not my answer, but it's one I happen to agree with. My undergrad history teacher, Dr. Frank Varney, taught me that if I can't provide a better explanation with my own words, then go with a quote. If somebody else says it better, then let them say it. The following passage is from Jordan Peterson's book, Beyond Order, 12 More Rules for Life. Those who are power-hungry, tyrannical, and cruel, even psychotic, desire control over others so that every selfish whim of hedonism can be immediately gratified. Now, power may accompany authority, and perhaps it must. However, and more important, genuine authority constrains the arbitrary exercise of power. This constraint manifests itself when the person with authority cares and takes responsibility for those over whom the exertion of power is possible. For example, the oldest child can take accountability for his younger siblings instead of domineering over and teasing and torturing them, and can learn in that manner how to exercise authority and limit the misuse of power. Even the youngest can exercise appropriate authority over the family dog. Such experience moderates what might otherwise be fantasies about the attractiveness of power, And that is where the life that is worth living is to be eternally found, and where you can find it, if only you are willing. Published in 2017 by CMON Games, Richard the Lionheart is a team-based strategy game for 2 to 6 players. In Richard the Lionheart, players are aligned with one of 3 possible factions: Richard, John, or Neutral. The Neutral faction is reserved for games where there is an odd number of players. Once players are given a faction, they assume a character from within the faction. On Team Richard, Maid Marian, Robin Hood, Little John, and Friar Tuck. Team John, Isabella, Prince John, Sheriff of Nottingham, and the Bishop of Ely. During the game, players travel point to point around the board taking actions, attempting to influence the ongoing crusade in your faction's favor while earning prestige points for themselves. Separate from the main board is the Crusade board, with 2 sets of tracks representing the momentum of the Holy War. The first set of tracks are Richard's army and Saladin's army. Team Richard works by sending support to bolster Richard's army. Team John does the same but for Saladin's army. The second set of tracks are King's Return and King's Treasure. Team Richard influences the return of the one and true king, while you're all savvy listeners, I'm sure you can guess what the other team does. The game is over when either one of the aforementioned tracks reaches the end, or the game round track reaches 10. Alrighty, so I've got my oversized yellow legal pad out. It's time for another game of Good News, Bad News. Good news: Richard the Lionheart is easy to set up and learn. Bad news: you won't want to set up Richard the Lionheart because it's not the brightest looking crayon in the box. Good news: Richard the Lionheart is a fun team versus team game. Bad news: Richard the Lionheart is a team versus team game, so it will rarely hit the table because it demands a large and even player count. Playing a 2-player game or a game with a neutral player is absolute trash. Don't even bother. It's 2-on-2 or 3-on-3, or we're playing Settlers of Catan. Good news: Richard the Lionheart encourages players to unite, work together, and work as a team. Bad news: except, no, it doesn't. And this is the biggest flaw of the game. I have never liked cooperative style games where there is only one winner. I didn't like it in Dead of Winter or Marvel Legendary, and I don't like it now. At the end of the game, you have a winning team, of course. However, members on the winning team are forced to find which player has the most prestige points. Whoever is on the winning team with the most points is the one and only winner. Ugh, I hate it. Semi-cooperative win conditions are the equivalent of drinking warm milk with lard in it. Ugh, gross. When I play Dead of Winter, we play 100% cooperative, but with a harder scenario. When I play Marvel Legendary, I never keep individual score. Sadly, Richard the Lionheart is more complicated than just a simple house rule. Sure, you can declare a winning team and forget about prestige points. However, by eliminating the importance of prestige points, players will find that performing the more heroic actions that award points undesirable because it requires spending cards or resources or extra turns, thereby breaking the game's fun factor. Players find it easier to just do the menial little things instead of the more heroic things that give points, which creates a boring game, quite frankly. I mean, who wants to be on a team working towards a shared objective while squabbling with each other like 2 kids in the back seat during family vacation? But then again, maybe that's the point. Maybe Richard the Lionheart does exactly what it's supposed to do. Because aren't we all driven by power? to exploit others for personal gain? And doesn't power corrupt us forever and ever, amen? Wasn't that the point of this episode? Damn, I guess so. Good thing it's just a board game. Right? My name is Andrew Davidson. I hope I have given you something to think about.